Welcome back, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com. Across the dateline in Japan, where it is the 19th of March, 2015. But today we're joined from the western reaches of my home and native land of Canada by Dr. Tim Ball of DrTimBall.com. That's DrTimBall.com. Also the author of the Deliberate Corruption of Climate Science, which I guess is a bit of a tongue twister, but also available, of course, in the show notes for today's conversation, where we are going to pick up where we left off last week. And people who have been following this series of conversations will know that we are talking to Dr. Ball about what I personally find to be a fascinating topic about the linkages between geography and climate and history, and also the theoretical frameworks that have been proposed in the past to explain those linkages. Again, a very in-depth but a very interesting conversation. If you didn't catch our first couple of conversations on this, they will again be linked up in the show notes for this conversation at CorbettReport.com. I hope you will go back and listen to them. But Dr. Ball, let's pick up from where we left off last time. And for those who were listening along, we did get into the 20th century. We got a toehold into the 20th century. We've discussed some of the theorists who have put forward some of these ideas, like Ellsworth Huntington and Ellen Semple Churchill, and we have gotten as far as Mackinder and his Heartland thesis, and I'd like to extend this on to throughout the 20th century to see what other ideas were proposed. But perhaps we could start with a brief couple of sentence synopsis of some of the ideas of Huntington and Churchill and Mackinder.
Yeah, well, Huntington and Churchill were really proponents of environmental and climatic determinism. That is the idea that people are a product of the environment and the climate in which they're born and live. And it really started, and Ellen was a student of Friedrich Ratzel. In fact, she went to Germany and studied under him. And Ratzel had written a book called Anthropogeography, which of course encompasses that idea that the anthropo, the human, and the geographic environment. The problem, Ratzel was arguing, and it's basically social Darwinism in a sense, that people are the product of the environment and the region in which they live and raised. But he also applied it to the concept of civilizations and groups of humans, in that he argued that a nation was an organism, just like any other organism, that would grow and expand, and some were weak and some were strong. And of course, the idea was that the survival of the fittest and the strongest. And so he was the one that proposed the idea that a state would grow at the expense of weaker states around it. And he said that the stronger states needed Lebensraum, or living space, and that's where that word came. It carries through actually the connection of it was through a guy by the name of Karl Haushofer. Haushofer was also a student of Ratzel's, and Haushofer had witnessed this idea of powerful, well-organized states dominating even larger states necessarily, because he'd watched the Sino-Russian War at the beginning of the 20th century, in the 1900s, and he'd watched Japan as a very, very well-organized, efficient military nation winning that war. But Haushofer had, as an aide-de-camp during the First World War, a guy by the name of Rudolf Hess. And Hess took those ideas of Ratzel's, the anthropogeography, and of course transmitted them through to Adolf Hitler. And Hess, of course, was one of the most enigmatic people in the whole of the Second World War, because suddenly he took an airplane and flew and crash-landed in Scotland. And it's never been fully explained why he did it. It certainly, there was a feeling amongst the Germans, like Hess, and even Hitler, they couldn't understand why they were fighting with Britain, because we've got more in common with Britain than we have with the French. So there were a lot of undercurrents going on there. But Hess was the one that transmitted these ideas into Hitler's ideas. Now, the difficulty with it is that Church or Huntington and others, and it actually goes back to Montesquieu, the French philosopher, and that is the idea that people living in certain regions have certain characteristics. Montesquieu talked about people, insular people living on islands, who develop certain genetic and cultural characteristics. People living on large flat plains develop characteristics, and one of them was, he argued, that they became sort of paranoid because there was no real edge to their territory. And people in mountain areas were, again, distinctly different. But what gave it all a bad name, of course, was all of these things combined into climatic determinism, creating the character of a people. And Hitler, of course, took that idea as justification for his domination of the Aryan race, the Aryan nation, the white people, as being coming from cool climates that created vigor and innovation and so on. And therefore, the Aryan whites were superior to the people from the hot climates that created lazy, indolent people. And so it basically became a racial thing. And we saw it, in a way, culminating at the 1936 Olympics, where Hitler wanted the whites to show their superiority, and Jesse Owens inserts himself into the middle of all of that. So these ideas were all boiling around these people and boiling around academia. And of course, then the politicians, as we see today and as politicians have always done, are always looking for academic, for which you can say intellectual justification for their actions. And so that's really what's happening in the transition from the end of the 19th century into the beginning of the 20th century. There's also another thing going on, and that is that not only are this idea of small, powerful nations expanding and occupying larger regions, but that led people to study the growth of colonial powers out of Europe. And of course, this was really a driving force. We talked about the Treaty of Berlin, where they stood around a map of Africa, the colonial powers, and simply divvied up the land and put in place artificial political boundaries that are the plague of today's world. So the idea of the larger power, that is, that overrode nationalism. So you had powerful nations, but they also then spread out with imperialism and colonialism that was the product of that. So people were trying to look at that and say, well, what made them successful? And of course, one of the classic studies we talked about was Mahan's study, which was the role of sea power, particularly with the British Empire. That without the British Navy, established by Samuel Pepys under Charles the First and Second, and Cromwell, the British Empire could not have controlled as much of the world as they did. But once the Mahan sea power theory faded, it was replaced by saying, okay, controlling the seas is important, but there's no rules on that. And this is where we got into people looking at the law of the sea. And this is a very interesting part of even of today's world. There's still no agreement, for example, on how the Arctic Ocean is divided up. It's simply been established as what's called the sector theory, and that exists simply because that's how the countries around the Arctic want it. But there's no formal establishment of that. Now, the law of the sea established its extension of the land control out into the oceans, the coastal regions, and the legal limit to a nation was set at 3 miles. And the reason for that was the distance you could fire a cannon when they were establishing these things. And a guy by the name of Grotius, G-R-O-T-I-U-S, published, the Law of the Sea ideas back in the 16th century, and they became very fundamental to how people operated when they were near other nations or how they operated on the high seas. For example, you also had the growth of agencies that were not tied to a particular land base. For example, the Dutch East India Company or the Hudson Bay Company. These were the forerunners of today's multinational corporations that sort of hover over national boundaries and operate wherever they can operate with being as independent of the national government as possible. And so the Hudson Bay Company, for example, they had a copy of Grotius's Law of the Sea in their library. It's still in the archives in Winnipeg. It's a quite a priceless book. But this was another part of the growing awareness of land, ocean, control of territory, growth of states, and all of the dynamics that were going on through this time period. Now, as I mentioned, Mahan's sea theory started to fade, and part of what caused it to fade a little bit was Napoleon's adventures. Now, Napoleon had what people saw as a bit of an obsession to take Moscow. He wanted to march into Russia. Now, and of course, the question is, why did he do that? Because, in fact, it ended up being his downfall. He didn't account for the winters, the distances, the maintenance of armies on very, very long supply lines and the vulnerability of that and so on. But it was the same obsession that Hitler had later on, that he had to take Moscow and control Moscow. Now, a lot of that came about because of the work of Sir Halford Mackinder. And Mackinder was sitting in his office in Oxford University and looking at a map of the world and saying, okay, if I wanted to control the world, which region of the world would I want to control? And he's looking at the map and noticing that the largest flat plain area in the world was the area around Moscow. Within 500 miles of Moscow, you draw a circle around, and it's a huge flat plain area. And by the way, not with quite the same intentions, but Moscow was established by the Vikings. The whole Romanov dynasty, starting at about 1000 AD, with the Vikings arriving there. And of course, they were sailors in that they sailed on the rivers, but they were also farmers. And what they were always looking for was large, flat areas where they could fish and farm. But anyway, Mackinder's not thinking about the Vikings. He's thinking about where would I establish a government that could control the whole world? So he called that region around Moscow the World Island. And it was several things about it that he thought made it important. One was, and this actually, of course, turned out not to be totally true, but we'll talk about that later. But there was an awareness at that time that civilizations evolved because they could produce surplus food. They could feed themselves. And so he wanted an agricultural area. And so he's looking at this green area on the map and say, well, you know, there's a huge Moscow plain. They can grow all kinds of foodstuffs there. But the second thing he wanted was natural boundaries, natural control of the region. So if you look at the Moscow plain and you've got the area of north of Russia along the Arctic coast, it's ice, it's solid ice most of the year. It's virtually inaccessible along that whole coast. And then you get over into the eastern area where you've got the Himalaya Mountains, and then to the south you've got the Alpine Mountains linking through the Himalayas and right across to the Pyrenees. And then you've got the Scandinavian mountains. So he said, well, look, these are natural physical defenses for anybody that would want to invade the world island. And therefore, you could control that world island using these natural defenses. But then somebody pointed out to him, but you've got a gate. You got a hole in your physical surroundings. And that hole is the North German plain through Belgium and through Central Europe and Poland, Czechoslovakia, as it was then, and right into the world island. So he said, okay, that's the gateway to the world island, and you must control that. That led, of course, to the creation of lines that people talk about, but they have they really don't understand why they were there, what they were doing. But there was the Maginot Line and the Siegfried Line, and these were lines of defenses, both in military posts and gun posts and barbed wire and all sorts of mines and so on, that were supposed to stop any army from invading through to the world island across the North German plain. Of course, this also made Berlin very central to controlling that gateway to the world island. So that was the revision that Mackinder made to his world island theory. And that's really where it sat up until the end of the Second World War.
And just as a note of clarification, excuse me here, but I believe Mackinder referred to the world island as Europe and Asia and Africa, that linked landmass, all of that together. He called the British Isles and the islands of Japan and similar islands, offshore islands, and then he referred to North America, South America, Australia as outlying islands. The area we're talking about here specifically is the pivot area, and specifically within the pivot area, something he called the heartland.
Well, exactly. And here's the other point with that. You see, when you look in the dictionary or wherever, Wikipedia, and they say, what are the continents? Well, they list Europe and Asia separately, but they're the same continent. And that's part of this, misconceptions about the continents. There is a physical divide between Europe and Asia, and it is the Ural Mountains. Now, we'll talk later on about how critical they are in Russia and the Soviet Union. But the Ural Mountains mark the point where the plates of the Earth's crust collide. So geologically, Europe and Asia are different. But in terms of the land and accessibility, they're combined politically into as one area. And now some people refer to that whole thing as Eurasia, but as I said, we still teach our children that Europe and Asia are two different continents when they're not at all. But what happened with Mackinder's heartland theory, as you say, as it became known, of the world island, that became the heartland. So what he said was that he who rules the world island or the heartland rules the world. Was a synopsis of his ideas, but after the Second World War, things had begun to change. Now, also, the pattern or type of war began to change. Now, Winston Churchill, who of course was a student of wars, identified only two types of wars, what he called the Wars of Kings, which were powerful people fighting over territory, and the peasants simply trying to survive. And these powerful people, they didn't have to be kings, they could be lords. They had their own private armies. And by the way, one of the hangovers of that in today's world is that if you go to the race courses in England, the jockeys wear silks. And the silks are the silks owned by the owners of the racehorses. Well, those silks are the modern version of the silks or shirts worn by the army of the landowner and the powerful people. And in fact, if you go to Berkeley Castle in the west of England in Gloucestershire, there is a room called the Cloth of Gold, and the walls are covered with the shirts of the army that the duke that owned that castle, Berkeley Castle, they fought in with Henry V in one of the battles in France. And he came back, and he was so proud of his troops and what he had done that he took all their shirts and lined the walls of the room with them. So you've got modern vestiges of this, and I say in the racing silks is another part of it. But what was occurring with what Churchill was saying was, okay, there's the wars of kings, powerful landowners fighting over territory, and hiring mercenary armies, and the ordinary peasants simply trying to survive. And then he said, the other wars are the wars of peoples. And he said, those are the most bloodthirsty. And of course, the example that you have going on all through this time are the civil wars. The American Civil War, for example, more people died in the American Civil War, more Americans, than died in the First and Second World Wars combined. And a lot of people don't know that. And so Churchill said, look, the wars of kings are simply almost like a monopoly game, that they're outside of now they affect the ordinary people, obviously, because their sons are being hired, and they have to billet and look after these people and so on. But basically, it was just a battle over control of territory, not over the people. The people were incidental to this. But the wars of between peoples, such as civil wars, and when you look at the in France, and you look at all of the throughout the world, at the civil wars and the loss of life and the brutality of them is something else. But during the Second World War and afterwards, a third type of war developed, which was an ideological war. And of course, as Churchill had warned in his speech in America about the Iron Curtain coming down across Europe. And what evolved out of that was an ideological war, a war over the minds of the people rather than the people themselves and their territory. And so things shifted completely. And it caused enormous confusion in people's minds because they could see the Second World War as a good war in that sense, that it was, you know, these people that were trying to control territory and land and dictate how people should live, and that's what Hitler was trying to do. Well, we stopped that nonsense. But then, with the communists against the capitalists, now it's a war for the minds of the people. And so the idea of the heartland theory picked up again, but in a very different way. Because the guy that created this idea was by the name of Spykman. That's Spykman. And Spykman said, look, you don't have to occupy the heartland to control it. That you can occupy the castle and control it, but you can control the castle by a siege around it. And so Spykman developed what he called the Rimland Theory. And the Rimland Theory, of course, was the area that encircled the heartland. And he also pointed out that in that Rimland, by controlling the Rimland, you controlled the world island, but you also controlled where most of the world's population lived, right? Because there weren't a lot of people living in the heartland. And you look at Russia today with 120 million people in that European sector. And so he said, look, what you got to do is set up treaties with groups around the heartland, in the Rimland, to contain the heartland, but also to contain communism, because it is now the threat. It's the second or the third war threat, the ideology. And how did he do that? Well, with Foster Dulles and other American senior states persons, they developed the treaty organization idea. And this involved four treaty organizations. But today, people only know of one of them or remember one of them because it's the only one that's still in existence. And when you understand that it's the only one in existence and how it was affected the Soviet Union, therefore the Russia, you'll see how bizarre it is that people are still supporting NATO. It's a hangover from the Cold War that makes no sense in today's world. But anyway, the treaty organizations that were set up because of Spykman's Rimland theory was the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And think how bizarre that was, because Canada, which is on the Atlantic, but it's hardly part of the surrounding of the Rimland. But the North Atlantic Treaty Organization controlled that area from Scandinavia right around down to the next treaty organization, which was the Central Treaty Organization. And then the next one over was the METO, M-E-T-O, the Middle East Treaty Organization. And that linked with the CETO, S-E-A-T-O, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. And all of these treaty organizations then ringed and controlled the Rimland to contain communism. Now, there were some very interesting parts of those organizations. One was that America was a member of all four because it was the world power emerging from the Second World War. But also, Turkey was the only other nation that was in more than two of the treaty organizations. And Turkey was in three of them. And the reason for that was, and it's interesting now because, of course, Turkey with regard to being in NATO or not in NATO, but Turkey was the only nation that was at the underbelly of the Soviet Union, and it was right across from the Ukraine. And the Ukraine was critical because Ukraine was the breadbasket of the Soviet Union, but it was also the area where they had most of their intercontinental ballistic missiles and so on. Turkey was a very, very important place. Now, just to illustrate how important and how long that lasted, when there was the battle between Turkey and Greece over Cyprus, and Jimmy Carter said, well, he was going to support Greece over that battle, Turkey said, fine, we're out of NATO. Whoa, they had to rush in and we're not on your side anymore. They had to rush in and calm Turkey down and say, no, we didn't mean that. And it was part of Jimmy Carter's lack of understanding of the geopolitics that was going on. But of course then the Suez Crisis put pressure on the Middle East Treaty Organization in 1956. And it effectively collapsed, and then the Central Treaty Organization collapsed because de Gaulle said he didn't want to be part of NATO or CENTO. He pulled the French pulled out of that. They were going to have their own nuclear forces that he called the Force de Frappe. And then the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization collapsed because countries like Australia and New Zealand that had got pulled into the Vietnam War as members of CETO said, no, we're out of here. We don't want any more part of this. And so the CETO organization collapsed. The only one that's left, of course, is NATO. And to suggest that, it's still viable, it is silly. But you also then understand why the Russians are so opposed to NATO, because NATO was deliberately created to control Russia. And so that's why people got to understand, why are the Russians getting so upset about NATO? Well, now you understand why.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that we should just stop and go over here, because they're extremely important. The first is that Turkey has been and continues to be, perhaps even increasingly so, an absolutely pivotal player on the geopolitical stage because of its physical location, because of its political leanings, and the fact that it's kind of straddles Europe and the Middle East area. And it's certainly a connection and an extremely important player. But also, your analysis is extremely interesting for drawing our attention to these now defunct treaty organizations that came along as sister organizations to NATO. In many ways, I think you could make the argument that NATO simply has subsumed the other treaty organizations, especially when you look at the global partnership programs that they have, and the various ways that even places as far afield as South Korea and other places are now linked with NATO, not actual member states, but are linked in partnership programs of various kinds. And when you plot these various NATO bases that now exist and various areas where they can deploy forces, it really is the Rimland Theory, I think, writ large. And now it is simply against Russia and China, as opposed to the old traditional heartland.
Yeah. Oh, no, I that's certainly the very valid points. But here's the problem. By continuing to call it NATO, in people's minds, and particularly the Russian minds, you give it that original objective of controlling and containing them. And of course, one of the things that is well known throughout Eurasian history is Slavic paranoia. I mean, Russians have always felt that they are encircled, that they have no access to the world. I mean, I know that was the big issue during the Cuban crisis, the containment of the Soviet Union and their lack of access to the oceans of the world. I mean, the reason that the Russia went into Afghanistan was because they wanted to have another outlet to the oceans of the world, and particularly to the Indian Ocean, because the Indian Ocean became extremely important as countries as these treaty organizations started to decline, and the huge fleets that both the Russians and the Americans put into the Indian Ocean, and the submarine fleets, for example, because that was one of the ironic things that happened. General MacArthur had warned the Americans, don't ever get involved in a land war in Asia. And of course, the Vietnam War was a good example of how bad it was. But the Americans, particularly under Kennedy, built up the navies, their navies, much like the British Empire. And very few people know this, but the Americans had huge task force fleets that sailed the oceans of the world, and they had different fleets in different oceans. They were usually centered around a very large aircraft carrier supported by battleships and destroyers. I remember being in Norfolk, Virginia, when the task force fleet that sailed up and down the Atlantic Ocean set sail from Norfolk, Virginia. And I said to the base admin officer, how many, he wouldn't tell me how many ships were involved because he didn't know, but there was quite a lot. And I said, well, how many people are on the base here? And he said, I don't know, but all I know is that, thousands of men disappear when that task force puts to sea. And of course, they have the Mediterranean fleet, and they had the Southeast Asian fleet, the 6th Navy, and so on. The Russians had the same thing. But that was only the surface war. And you were containing the lands. So it was almost back to the Mahan theory again of control of the oceans. And one of the, but underneath all of this was where the real war was going on, and that was the submarine war. Now, we could talk about that in a different context, but I mean, I was involved in that as an operations officer and involved in the Cuban crisis and monitoring Russian submarines, particularly on the East Coast and the Arctic. I mean, one of the things that's going on right now is China has a fleet of 70 nuclear submarines. And people are not watching these things at all. And a nuclear submarine is virtually undetectable. And so what was really going on at the end of the Cold War was a submarine war with a surface fleet war as well. And of course, that was the real issue. And when you've got an intercontinental ballistic missile submarine that can fire 10 intercontinental ballistic missiles, each with 10 warheads on each missile, that's just one submarine, and it's virtually indetectable. But that was where the real war was going on. But back to the treaty organizations and your correct observation about the Rimland and controlling it. As I said, the treaty organizations fell apart, and then the Vietnam War showed that trying to contain communism on the land in Asia was a very, very difficult process. Now, there's another theory that comes in after Spykman and the Rimland theory, and that is from a book written by Saul Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, and it's called Geography and Politics in a Divided World. And Cohen was teaching at a New England university. I've forgotten which one. I think it was Clark. But John Kennedy became a student of Cohen and his views of the world. Now, part of that, of course, was the idea that the world was becoming interlinked by trade, and that trade was then a vehicle by which you could bring nations into your sphere. And of course, that linked in with the General Agreement on Trade and Tariff. And Kennedy introduced the concept of most favored nation, that it instead of dominating the country by power and war and military, you simply just said, look, if you accept our political ideas of democracy and freedom and all the rest of it, then we will give you special trading favors with the United States. And of course, the United States was such a dominant world trade nation at that time that they were able to do it. I mean, China desperately wanted most favored nation status from the Americans, and the same as Putin later on wanted to become a member of the World Trade Organization, and was willing to agree to sign Kyoto, even though he knew the science of it was rubbish. But what happened was the Europeans said, look, if you don't sign Kyoto, we won't let you join WTO. So trade became an overriding factor as well. But Cohen's view of geography and politics in a divided world was he looked at each country and said, is it an inward-looking country or is it an outward-looking country? What is the history of this country? And, of course, the obvious outward-looking countries were countries like Japan or like Britain, the great trading nations of the world. But there were also essentially landlocked countries. I mean, China was another one. China called itself the Middle Kingdom because all it was interested in doing was seeing itself as the most important part of the world, and just keeping an eye on what was going on around its edges, such as in Tibet and these other places. But they really were not interested in these great imperial and colonial expeditions to take over territory. In fact, when the book came out, I think it's 1492, no, not 14, was, sorry, I've forgotten the title of the book, but there was a book written about one of the only known Chinese fleets of exploration and discovery in the middle of the 15th century, where they built these massive junks and actually sailed to Africa. That's the only time in history that there's been any record of China getting out beyond its own area and the periphery. And so China was looked on as an inward-looking nation. And then what Cohen found was, so you could divide the nation. That fits, of course, in nicely with the trade, which nations are very important for trade and which aren't, which are involved in trade. Again, we look at the problem of Russia, where it's essentially landlocked. How does it get access to the world's trade markets? And of course, it because it was so landlocked, it was very easy to control shipping and submarine movement in and out of Russia. In fact, the Russians became so desperate because if they got out of the Black Sea from their submarine posts there, they were only into the Mediterranean. And then they still had to get out of the Mediterranean out into the Atlantic. And they built and connected rivers all the way from the Black Sea right up to Murmansk on the White Sea, on the Arctic Ocean. And they could transport submarines, full-size submarines, right across the European part of Russia between those two regions. And so it's a measure of how important Russia being landlocked was to their view of themselves, but also, as I say, because they weren't seen as a great trading nation. Now, so Cohen's ideas fit with Kennedy's ideas of trade and tariff and using trade as a weapon of war, for the want of a better term. But what Cohen found was, there were two regions in the world that he simply couldn't put into either the inward or outward looking category. One was Southeast Asia, which was, of course, the Vietnam, Thailand, Laos, and so on. And the other was the Middle East. And so what he did was he designated those as shutter belts. And he argued that the superpowers, whether it was Russia or America, would never, ever be able to achieve any control over these regions because there was so much divisiveness within them that the minute a superpower aligned itself with one group, they automatically made enemies of the other group. And, of course, we see that. The Southeast Asia has settled down a little bit, but the Middle East certainly is fulfilling Cohen's idea of shatter zones, and so those were the major strategies of geopolitics going essentially spanning the 20th century, and it helps you understand why different regions are so important. In today's world. But now there were a couple of things in the middle of all of that that changed the balance quite considerably. One was, of course, the construction of the Suez Canal. Because now, where there was a battle in the 19th century for control of Africa with the Treaty of Berlin and the Brits with the Cape to Cairo, so they could control the whole Central Africa, keep the other colonial powers separate. Now, that wasn't important anymore. That you could go right through the Suez Canal from Europe into Asia, Southeast Asia, and bypass Africa. Africa essentially became a troublesome appendage on the Eurasian continent. Now, the other country that was interesting in all of this, and I'll get back to the second thing, was India. I mean, India was neutral during the Cold War because it was of no strategic value or importance to anybody. And to put it bluntly, their view was that if India was on your side, all you had was a billion problems. And you didn't need that. So India was neutral, not because it chose to be, but because nobody wanted it. It was just left there. But the other thing that changed this whole strategy, and you mentioned in your earlier comments quite correctly about North America, Africa, and Australia or Australasia, these are outliers to this world island and control of the world island. But what changed that was, of course, the development of North America. The most successful trading nation in the world. When you look at the end of the Second World War, the dominance of world trade that the Americans had was absolutely unequaled in history. But one of the things that changed the orientation of that was, of course, the Panama Canal. Now, that is, again, a center of focus because they didn't want to build the canal through Panama. They wanted to build it through Nicaragua originally, because it's a longer distance, but that you've got Lake Nicaragua, which is a very large lake that shortens the length of canal you had to build, and it's a much lower elevation across there. The Panama Canal was, when you look at the cuts and the digging and the loss of life that went on there, what's going on right now is that there is a new group of nations forming a larger power block called the BRICS nations. This is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. And, of course, these nations are trying to break the control of the world trade, particularly the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank. And they, one of the ways they're doing this is that China has now built the largest container fleets in the world, and the Chinese are funding the building of a canal through Nicaragua, which they say will be in operation by the end of 2017. And so these geopolitical things and strategies are still in vogue, but of course they function within the legacies of what has gone on before them. And so that's very, very, very broad overview of the geopolitical world and how it's functioned.
Absolutely fascinating overview. So thank you for taking the time to do that. And there's so much material to explore here that I think we'll probably need an entire other conversation on the 21st century and where we can expect these types of things to go from here and the development of the BRICS and things of that nature. But let me ask a question that may be peripheral to this conversation, but maybe in some ways at the heart of what's going on. We've talked about some of the people like Mahan with his sea power theory that shaped so much of what went forward from there, and others also, Mackinder and others, talking about the importance of land power versus sea power and things of that nature that have gone on in this literature before. But what about the development of air power in the 20th century? Obviously, we are still very much reliant on shipping lanes on the seas and things of that nature for moving materials. But from a military strategic viewpoint, obviously the development of air power was a game-changing event. How did that change the perception of this geostrategic calculation that went on in terms of points of particular interest in controlling the world?
And another very, very good question. A lot of people don't realize that 95% of world trade is done through containers. Containerization also is another thing we need to talk about, because it changed the world, because you could simply move a container from a ship to a rail, to a lorry or truck, and without unloading or and so on. That altered the whole trade pattern. But your question about air power became a factor in the First World War when, first of all, there were balloons, and balloons were used for two things. One was for observation, aerial photography, and seeing a wider view of the battlefield. But you could also drop bombs from balloons, but they were very vulnerable, of course, to being shot down. But then the aircraft came in the First World War. It's interesting to note how that influences today's world is so much of the terminology that you hear in weather reports come from military terminology. So in the weather, on a weather map, they talk about fronts. Well, that was a military term that was applied, and it was done by a Norwegian weatherman by the name of Bjerknes, B-J-E-R-K-N-E-S. And you also, they also talk about fronts advancing and retreating, and they talk about outbreaks of cold air. And so, and then of course what you got was airports that were built at the on the edges of cities, and that's where your weather stations were located, because the weather was so important to flying, and that became a factor in the type of data and where we collected. But air power was essentially limited. It's limited by the range of the airplanes. It's limited by the speed of the airplanes. And as you're seeing with the air war that Obama is trying to conduct in the Middle East, you can only achieve certain things in the air. At some point, you've got to put boots on the ground, as is discussed nowadays. Now, the air power had a great influence in the Second World War in this way, in that the initial blitzkrieg, an invasion of Poland, for example, came with the Stuka bombers, taking out critical targets. But all they were doing was softening it up, loosening it up for the armies that came in behind very, very quickly. And the other thing was that aircraft, when they're sitting on the ground, are extremely vulnerable. And so the air power had great opportunities, but it was very limited. Then you got the Battle of Britain, of course, and one of the interesting things, I did a lot of work on this with a fellow who was writing a book about the Battle of Britain. People, I don't want to take anything away from those brave pilots of the Spitfire pilots and the Hurricane pilots of the Battle of Britain, but what happened on the time when Germany decided to attack? There was a very, very large low pressure system sitting up on the North Sea, with northwest winds blowing right across Britain towards France, with upper level winds of 100 to 120 miles an hour, and this was with aircraft that could only fly 150 miles an hour, so the Germans could take off from France. But by the time they got to Britain, they had virtually no fuel left. They couldn't stay there very long. And, of course, they had to go back and refuel. And that lasted for 3 days over the Battle of Britain. And then you had the problem, of course, also of accuracy. Bomb accuracy was very, very, very bad. The number of bombs that actually hit the targets was minimal. But the bombing was important from a psychological point of view, because it's like almost like guerrilla warfare. It doesn't matter how many people are affected by it in getting killed or injured, but the fact that somebody can attack you and your government can't defend you against it. And I talked to people going on the bombing runs in the Second World War. Yes, they were important up to a point. For that ability to strike at remotely, but in terms of its influencing the war, it really wasn't a factor in the larger sense. Now, what did change things, of course, was when the missiles come into play, and then you start to get longer and longer range missiles, until you got the missile that really changed the direction of the Cold War, which was the intercontinental ballistic missile. Now, I mentioned the ones that were on the submarines. But everybody talks about the Cold War as an East-West war, but it wasn't. It was a North-South war. They didn't build radar sites across northern Canada for nothing. They built them there because that's where the attacks were going to come from. They were going to come over the pole. The east-west idea was simply because the map on the wall in the school was a gross distortion, because here you had North America on one side of the map, you had Europe and Asia on the other side of the map. That's an east-west war, but it wasn't. It was a north-south war. And so regions that became strategically important, as I said, such as northern Canada, And they built three lines. You had the Mid-Canada line, you had the tree line, and you had the distant early warning line. And these were to deal with where the attacks were going to come from, both by air power, but also by intercontinental ballistic missile. The same thing was going on in the Soviet Union. The Soviets had defensive lines across the north, but they had the problem that they've always had in that part of the world, the attacks coming from the east through China. And what they did was they set up a line of which they would fall back to, much like they did with, you know, the scorched earth policy. And so the whole Soviet strategy was, look, you gradually withdraw and you let these armies die on the frozen plains of Russia. So they had lines of defense from the Great Wall of China falling back towards the Ural Mountains. And the last strategy to defend was the heartland again. So there it came into play again. And of course, one of the things people forget is that Russia is European Russia, that is west of the Ural Mountains, and then Asian Russia, which is east of the Ural Mountains. They've never got along. They've always been hostile. The Mongol hordes raiding out of Asia into Russia. I mean, that's what Catherine the Great was so afraid of. And so the Cold War actually was the ballistic missile. But here's the thing: the only thing that changed with the missile war was the length of time it took for the missile to reach you, and then the length of time that you had to respond. So where with an aircraft, and you had Russian bombers, the Bear bomber, the Ilyushin Bear flying over the North Pole, got picked up on radar, and you launched your aircraft in response to that out of places like in Canada, like North Bay and so on. But you had the anti-missile missiles. So with a missile launched out of Russia, an ICBM, you had about 8 to 12 minutes in which to say, no, we better launch a missile to shoot that one down. And so you have these missile defense systems built, particularly across the northern United States. So you have these missile silos in North Dakota and all of these states with the people sitting there monitoring these missiles. I'm not aware of any one of them that was ever fired in anger. But the other thing that you had was Strategic Air Command, which was set up specifically to combat the attack of Russia or Soviet Union over the polar regions. And what they would do is you belong to a Strategic Air Command squadron. You as an air crew were assigned to a particular airplane, and that airplane was then rotated through three different bases. So your three bases might be Plattsburgh, New York, Westmalling in England, and Goose Bay, Labrador. And wherever you were assigned, you rotated through those three bases. It's not a surprise that the divorce rate in Strategic Air Command was 90%. But what happened was these aircraft took off every hour. There were aircraft in the air flying towards Russia, that if a missile came, their job was to go and attack targets in the Soviet Union. They'd reach a certain point, and a recall message was sent. If they didn't receive the recall message, they continued on to target. And there were some very interesting books written about that became quite popular movies.
Yeah. What could go wrong, right?
Yeah, well, exactly. Failsafe was one. I mean, the other story that I can tell you about, because I talked to the guy that it happened to, but that in NORAD, which is the North American Air Defense, they had a headquarters under a mountain in Colorado, and they had a complete map of the world up on the wall. And if a missile was launched anywhere, it showed up on the map almost instantly. And the people with their fingers on the nuclear response buttons were American military and Canadian military, because it was defending North America. And they got a signal from the computer and on the wall map that a missile had been launched in the Soviet Union, were heading towards North America. The American wanted to push the response button almost immediately. The Canadian said, no, let's hang on a minute. There's something, they're not comfortable about this. What it turned out was something that they hadn't allowed for, and that is that as the moon rose up over the Arctic, the distant early warning radar detected that, and then interpolated the 300,000 miles into 3,000 miles. And the computer then said, logged it as a launch of a missile from the Soviet Union, when in fact it was simply the moon rising up over the horizon in the north.
The number of times the world has been on the brink of total annihilation is worrying to think about.
We'll get into all of this sort of thing, but when you start to look, nothing bears investigation, and I've been in many inquiries into disasters and catastrophes, and I've given evidence in courts. What you find is that we've got virtually no data. Every rule in the book was either being broken completely or certainly badly bent. Very few people were doing what they were supposed to be doing. And what Shakespeare called a comedy of errors, by sheer fluke, becomes a tragedy of errors. And that what you realize is that, yeah, we're just a veneer away from disaster all the time. And so we teeter along in this world. And every time they afterwards they have an investigation, and that's what they always come up with. Very little data, rules are being bent and broken, and of course then they put all sorts of rules and regulations in place that don't solve the problem at all.
Of course, yes. Well, yeah. Unfortunately.
But back to your air power thing. And notice, by the way, now again, Putin is flexing his muscles by sending those Cold War long-range bombers, like the Bear. They've been flying over Britain a great deal recently, and of course causing all sorts of concern about, because they don't communicate with the civilian control of aviation. And there's even been Russian bombers seen in Arctic Canada and off the east coast of Canada and so on. And so this is just Putin pushing the envelope, pushing the limits. And what went on during the Cold War was that the Russians and the Americans, both of them, were using civilian aircraft to stray offline and see how quickly the other side responded. Now, the commercial jet that got shot down over Korea, the KLM jet, was... That's what it was doing. Well, the Soviets said, hey, we don't care if it's civilian. We're going to shoot it down.
Yes, the interestingly numbered KL-007. But
yeah,
Yeah. I think we'll have to leave this conversation there. Unfortunately, again, time limitations are going to preempt the rest of this conversation. But as I say, I think we will continue this conversation to talk about the 21st century implications of some of these concepts, because I hope people do reflect on the fact that these overarching theoretical frameworks are not just philosophical. At the very least, they can become self-fulfilling prophecies, and they can shape the way that policies are dictated, and also the way that future wars are actually waged. It's a truism that, for example, Mahan's sea power theory not only shaped the naval strategies of the West for the beginning part of the 20th century, but that played all the way into World War II, and the Japanese naval planners who knew about the Americans relying on Mahan, so they were playing sort of this complicated strategy of, well, we should play against the weaknesses of that theory. And so these types of things can truly shape the course of history one way or another. Yep. So I think it's important we reflect on that and use it to predict what may be coming in the future. So again, Dr. Ball, you have given us more than enough to bite off and chew for this week, and I hope we can again continue this conversation. Let's direct people once again to drtimball.com, which again will be linked up in the show notes for today's conversation. And as always, I'll leave it up to you if there's any other resources you'd like to direct people to at this time.
Well, I think that I mentioned Cohen's book, Geopolitics in a Divided World. It's a very interesting one. The other one, of course, is the whole idea of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade and the Most Favored Nation status. I think that that whole idea about trade is a really fascinating area.
Absolutely. Well, let's get into that next time. For now, we'll leave it there. Dr. Tim Ball, thank you so much for your time, as always.
Thank you, James.